Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on. Not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio. Radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. This is your co-host, Chris Driscoll, and along with me tonight, our other co-host, Rainer Shea. Rainer, how are you?
Hello. I'm quarantining, and I'm figuring out the details of these narratives and all this information about the origins of COVID-19. Throughout these months, the perceptions of exactly where the virus came from has seemingly been shifting, and the United States has been trying to manage the narrative by ratcheting up accusations against China, but hopefully with our work as independent journalists, this is going to blow back up in their faces.
Yes. Yeah, we'll see. It's a race to the truth. Meanwhile, we have a lot of nefarious characters attempting to erase the truth out from under us. Isn't it always the case? So, yeah. Tonight's theme, so to speak, what this show is titled, COVID-19 is part of the U.S. war on the Chinese people. And we will explain that quite a bit further during this show. Of course, Rainer brings up some really big news that came out on Thursday, I guess it was. Actually, a week prior to that, ABC reported that a report by intelligence agencies, and this is a report specifically by the National Center for Medical Intelligence, had warned of a COVID virus pandemic in November of last year. So that brings up a lot of really interesting points. Of course, the Trump regime immediately denied three times in honor of Easter. Denied the that they had any, that there was any such report in the DOD, and that he was unaware of any report. However, then a news article in an Israeli newspaper, the Israeli Times, I think it was called, came out last Thursday revealing that U.S. intelligence agencies had warned Israel of this coming coronavirus in November, and that they reported that NATO was also warned, NATO countries were warned, and, of course, the American government was warned by its own intelligence agencies of the coronavirus in November, which is kind of strange. There's a great article in the aftermath of that by Finian Cunningham, one of my favorite independent reporters. He's also, like I was at one time, a science journalist. Anyway, Finian asks the pertinent question, why is it that intelligence agencies of the American empire knew about this coronavirus before the Chinese government knew about it? Because the Chinese government did not even know about this coronavirus outbreak, first identified in Wuhan, China, in December, after November. So brings up some really interesting questions there, Rainer. And I'm wondering, I'd love to get your take on this, because I know you've been looking into it, as you just said. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on this report from the National Center for Medical Intelligence in November is.
Yeah, well, the thing about these theories we're passing around about the potential for the coronavirus being a bioweapon or it having originated in the U.S. is that, well, at first glance, this view comes from only some, it's indeed odd that the U.S. apparently knew about this virus before China did. And when you put this up against all these other details that have come out, like the Fort Kettrick story, like like the fact that U.S. troops in Wuhan in October, their arrival there seemingly correlated with the outbreak around Wuhan. There's also the findings from Taiwanese virologists. I'm going to link to this virologist's findings in my next article about how, given the strains of the virus within Taiwan, it was clear that this aspect of the virus came from the United States, not from China. It was also apparently true for the coronavirus strains within Iran and Italy. The virus came from the United States, or that the story the United States is putting out about the virus's origin doesn't line up with the facts. And thus we're seeing this increasingly hysterical campaign from the U.S. media to blame China. Right now, their main line they're using is that China mismanaged the virus, that the supposed corruption with the Communist Party of China has created this global pandemic. And there is even a rumor being spread around in the media, and even by Donald Trump himself, that the virus could have escaped from a Wuhan lab. This is as far as they're taking it. They're taking it increasingly far, seemingly, as the weeks go by. And hopefully, as I said, this is going to backfire, because there's absolutely no evidence for from a Wuhan lab. The World Health Organization agrees with China's statements about there being no evidence for this. And when you look at the details, China really can't be characterized as having mismanaged the virus. If we look at all these details enough, it becomes apparent that the United States' ineptitude and/or malicious behavior caused this virus to spread.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You were coming in a little bit weak there and distorted. Just to let you know, I don't know if you can do anything to adjust your microphone or whatever about that. About two-thirds of the way through, all of a sudden it started coming in better. I don't know if you maybe have an intermittent contact in your cord or whatever. Anyway, topic number two, moving right along here, COVID-19 is bringing the vulnerable U.S. empire towards collapse. Now, this comes from an article that you wrote, Rainer, and a really well-crafted, well-researched article, I think, that brings together a lot of valuable information about the decline of the empire, of the evil empire that we call the American Empire, the fact that COVID-19 pandemic crisis, the crisis that's coming out of that pandemic, is exacerbating this decline. So I'm wondering if you might just share with us a little of your thinking in that article and what brought you to this conclusion, some of the evidence, and we'll go on from there.
Yes, this article discusses mainly the collapse of capitalism, or the crisis of capitalism that's happening right now, and that's being experienced both by the United States and by so many of the countries that it depends on. We're seeing how an economic collapse is making Israel less stable, the acceleration of neoliberalism and the ensuing recession is impacting Brazil. Now all of these countries are being impacted, like South Africa. That's one example, and how the destabilizing events are of course weakening the ability for these vassal states, for Washington, to carry out Washington's goals. I mean, Bolsonaro's Brazil, in the last month, it's been used as a tool to try to militarily intimidate Venezuela, which has been happening at the same time as Bolsonaro's deliberate mismanagement of the crisis has made him in danger of impeachment. And at the same time as class conflict within Brazil is rapidly moving towards escalation. And this is happening at the same time as the EU and NATO are moving towards closer to a breakup. We're seeing how the EU countries have been acting somewhat in conflict with each other, how Germany and the Netherlands have been unwilling to carry out Washington's anti-Russian war games, how really there's been accelerated breakdown of the EU-NATO alliance and a breakdown of cooperation and more nationalistic isolation among these countries. So I wrote this article a little while ago, and that's the best I can remember of its main themes. The point of what I'm trying to say, though, is that all of the weak points in the structure of American hegemony are being exposed with this virus, and the global power balance is shifting. Part of that is the fact that more countries are joining China. More countries are becoming aligned with China to varying degrees, like how the president of Serbia has assessed that he said in a statement last month that European unity is a myth. All of these countries aren't helping Serbia. Only the People's Republic of China is helping Serbia. To the rest of these countries, thanks for nothing. And you also see how last month Italy joined with China's New Silk Road against the advice of Italy's allies. That's one indication of how, as the United States economy declines and as China's economy rises, there is an increased global shift towards aligning with China. And the reaction from the U.S. political and media class is, of course, a nationalistic, fascistic war fever, a campaign to demonize China and to escalate the Cold War tensions. I'm seeing things like calls from these right wing figures to further cut off business ties with China. I'm seeing provocations by the United States in the South China Sea. I'm seeing continued accusations that China started this virus, and sadly, that's one of the downsides of COVID-19 in terms of geopolitics, that being used as a very powerful propaganda tool to make seemingly most Americans hate and fear China.
Yes, and we've seen indications that an overwhelming number of Americans, I don't know, something like between 70% and 80% of Americans have now turned rabidly anti-Chinese, are demanding, I saw a poll last week, Americans demanding, I think I reported this last week, Americans demanding, I think it was something like 72%, if I'm not mistaken. Don't quote me on that. I'll have to go back and reference that poll. But a large number of Americans demanding total economic warfare against China, which, of course, has already been taking place over the last decade since Obama started this war against China with his so-called pivot to Asia. The anti-Chinese pro-war sentiment has been whipped up into a frenzy in the United States. We've seen this in multiple articles in just the last week that I've read. I've also read on the good side of the ledger, I've read multiple articles by left commentators about the danger of this anti-Chinese frenzy that's being whipped up in the United States, about the fact that this propaganda is based on lies against China, and we'll be talking a lot more about that in the coming topics for the rest of the show, practically, almost the rest of the show. But this is becoming frightening to me because it's the kind of anti-China frenzy, hysteria. It is the kind of conditions that inevitably lead to a hot war. We already know that a cool war, we might call it, in between a hot war and a cold war, is already going on and has been since Obama started this in 2011 against China. We know that the United States has been carrying out hybrid asymmetrical warfare using terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism, like the terrorists in the far northwestern part of China. That are U.S. sponsored, many of them Al-Qaeda affiliated terrorists have been carrying out for the last 15 to 20 years, been carrying out acts of terrorism within China. We know about the economic warfare that the United States has been waging against China all this time, sanctions, which are not real sanctions. There's no legitimacy to the American so-called sanctions against China. They are actually economic warfare against China. These sanctions, so-called, are not sanctioned by the United Nations, and therefore they are not legal sanctions. They are not legitimate sanctions. As you mentioned, Rainer, the almost hot war being carried out between the Chinese Navy and the American Navy in the South China Sea. This is really getting to frightening proportions, because all it takes is a couple of mistakes in this kind of environment to lead to a nuclear holocaust that brings down the entire world, basically. I mean, it won't destroy the world, but it'll destroy the all humanity on the world. Which, from our perspective, being human beings, it's might as well be the end of the world. It's the end of the world for us. Very frightening. And we'll be talking more about that. the anti-war movement in the United States needs to step up now with an all-out anti-war movement that demands U.S. hands off China, an end to U.S. sanctions against China, an end to U.S. terrorism against China, an end to U.S. economic sabotage against China. The anti-war movement really needs to step up right now, and hopefully, you know, I'm not even focused, tell you the truth, on the broad public on this issue. I don't think that's where we start. I think we start on focusing our attention on the anti-war movement and building up a real anti-war movement to stop this American war on China before it becomes a nuclear war, before it becomes a hot war. That's what I'm hoping. Topic number three. A Stanford University study, just issued last week, has found that the rate of COVID-19 infection is 50 to 85 times higher than official figures. If you imagine that, I mean, what they're saying is something like half the country is infected with this virus. And, you know, the thing about something like this Stanford University study, Stanford is one of our premier universities in the United States, highly respected. The thing about this kind of study, it makes logical sense to me, because I have felt all the way along that with the limited testing going on, the rate must be tremendously higher. Now, the authors of the study point out that if, in fact, their study is correct and their data is correct, they're just going by the data that they've collected, that would mean the mortality rate of the virus is quite a bit lower than it has before thought to be. I don't know how low. I think they said between between 0.01% and 0.02%, which would put it make it about twice as deadly as the common flu, as opposed to what it looks like now, which it looks like the virus is tens of times more deadly than the common flu. So, interesting study, and I thought I'd bring it up to for discussion, because, you know, I am really fearful at this point with all of this discussion being pushed by the Trump regime that the shutdown across the country, which is really like a partial shutdown to begin with. It has not been in every state, first of all, and that has not been a real shutdown, in strictly enforced shutdown in most states. But I am fearful of the idea that what Trump is pushing, a quick end to the shutdown, would lead to a really bad second wave of this flu epidemic, of this this virus. You know, I also read a statistic that during the Spanish flu outbreak of 1918, during the first wave, about 3 million people died. But then, after people stayed home and shut down for a good while, and they started feeling like, okay, the shutdown should be over because people aren't dying at the same rate, and they all started coming back out. The second wave hit, and in the second wave, something more than 50 million people died. So, you know, it's something that we should really be cautious about. What are your thoughts, Brainer?
Well, let's see. How does this relate to politics? Well, the obvious thing that this study implies is that our government has been trying to downplay the extent of the virus, and this reflects the way that that other capitalists or governments around the world have been trying to handle this, and the way that pro-capitalist narratives have been trying to portray it as not something so serious that we'll need to keep shutting down the economy to this extent and endangering capitalist profits. And Jair Bolsonaro, as I mentioned in that article of mine you read, has gone so far as to publicly deny that there's really any seriousness to the virus, and try to reopen the economy totally after had even been a few weeks when he tried to reopen it, and so that's put Jair Bolsonaro in a pretty unique position worldwide. But Donald Trump is barely any better. He wanted to reopen the economy on Easter, and he barely listened to his first who convinced him to extend that date to April 30th. And now, in this last week, Trump has been advocating for rebellion within the states where the anti-quarantine protests have been going on. With all these armed men, armed Trump supporters, have been marching in the streets. So there's obvious black shirt imagery there, and these events in those last weeks have really been in line with what I've personally been expecting the Trump presidency would lead to, which is Trump encouraging his supporters to commit acts of violence for the political benefit of himself and of capitalist interests. So the end result is going to be a number of more unnecessary deaths and for the benefit of whatever corporations that get more profits. So this is a symptom of the deep systemic problems that have been exposed during this virus. These capitalist countries aren't equipped to handle a crisis like this in the way that countries like China, Cuba, Vietnam, and the DPRK are. The capitalist class wants to keep the economy open at all costs, and they're willing to sacrifice lives for this. So that's why I expect that the virus isn't going to go away anytime soon within the United States. That's where it gets depressing and scary, because what's going to be the situation a year from now? It just seems like it's going to go down momentarily, then reappear because of the incurable ineptitude and inadequacy of our healthcare system and our economic system in general.
Yeah, it brings up a lot of ironies. One thing that strikes me about these protests, encouraging, these protests are against the actions of the Trump regime. I mean, Trump is the head of government. He is the head of state. And it was his government that instituted all these standards for the shutdown, that has done everything in the most shoddy, inept way to respond properly to this public. So, you know, he had nothing to do with this, even though he's the head of government.
Cut out.
He is the dictator over this government. He is the U.S. Constitution and presidential orders since FDR give the presidency virtual dictatorial control over the entire federal government, including the entire military, the entire CIA and intelligence apparatus. He controls it all. So now he's encouraging all these people to come out and protest what his government has been doing. Irony of ironies. I think he really does know what he's doing, but he is as stupid as his followers are, and his followers are stupid enough not to even think about this. Fact. It really gets to me, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes. And Fox News is glad to encourage it.
Yeah. Glad to encourage it, and they do. No, I mean, I think that a kind of Trump thinks that he's going to achieve a kind of controlled social anarchy that undermines his enemies. I guess he would hope. But these kind of things have a way of getting away from people. They're not things that are easily controlled. So we'll see. We'll see how this goes. Anyway, moving on to topic four, which is the liberal war on the Chinese people. Now, this also comes from an article that you wrote, Rainer. You've been really prolific this last week. You've been knocking the articles out. I've been eagerly anticipating each one. Anyway, this article you had about the liberal war on the Chinese people. Wonder if you could explain that a little bit more.
In this article, I observed how in the last couple of years or so, some of the most influential and trusted outlets on the mainstream American left have been participating in the general trend towards negative coverage of China. In August 2018, The Intercept's Mehdi Hassan published this breathless headline about how a virus is interning over a million Muslims, even though, as the article explains, this claim came from a misleading Reuters headline, and this claim was really had no substantiation and was extrapolating. And then in these last couple of years, in particular, we've seen continual statements and content from outlets like The Intercept, like Democracy Now. That portray China in a negative light, or that go along with the rest of the media's narratives about it. The Uyghur, the Xinjiang content in particular has been really egregious and disturbing because, as you know from my article last July, Amy Goodman had on a man named Adrian Zenz, who's from the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. The Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation is really qualifiably a far-right institution that proposes the so-called double genocide theory of the Holocaust, which rewrites the Holocaust in order to try to implicate the Soviet Union in the killing of the Jews. And the foundation is tied to a network of hate groups and Holocaust revisionists. Amy Goodman would have this figure on her program to promote really transparent falsehoods about what China is doing in Xinjiang. That shows how far from reality the mainstream media discourse has gotten in this area, the era of U.S. imperial decline. Remember that quote from my article that quoted a book that Amy Goodman wrote in 2006 about how all of these pundits, these U.S. pundits, were complicit in the propaganda of the Bush administration, and how they had on so-called experts who promoted falsehoods. That's now what Democracy Now! Has been doing in recent years when it's come to China. I wonder why Democracy Now! And The Intercept, particularly Democracy Now!, would choose to participate in this anti-China bandwagon. What do you think has been their motive? Are they just inept, or how can they incredibly accept this stuff?
Well, of course, early on, I mean, when I first became aware of Amy and her show, I don't know how long ago, this was probably 25 years ago at least, maybe 30 years ago. I can't remember exactly how long Amy's show's been on, but I used to listen to Pacifica religiously because it used to be a great radio network. It was founded by communists and socialist activists in the 40s. And for a long time, it really was. It really followed its charter to work for the working class and to work for the people. So anyway, for a long time, I really thought very highly of Amy. I've met her a few times. She's a very charming individual personally and in person, she always had great shows way back in the day. However, 2008, November 2008, was a real watershed period of time for Amy Goodman. That was the time when Barack Obama was elected. And when Barack Obama was elected, Amy started changing her attitude towards the Democratic Party, becoming much more friendly with the Democratic Party, and being sucked into the Democrat Party pro-imperialist, anti-cap, anti-socialist, anti-communist vortex of the Democrat Party. And I've seen a huge change in Amy Goodman ever since then. And, I mean, we've seen, like, in the U.S. invasion of Syria starting in 2011, Amy has consistently sided with the far right wing. You know, she's consistently sided with the terrorists against the Syrian people, as an example. So it does not surprise me at all that Amy's feeding in. I've only heard about this third person. I mean, I no longer listen to Amy, to Amy's show. But it no longer surprises me that she would side with the terrorists in the, what do they call that, Xinjiang province of far northwestern China. Say it again.
Xinjiang.
Xinjiang. I'm sorry. My memory is really poor for Chinese words, unfortunately. I've tried to improve that, but I haven't improved it yet. There's always hope, though. Hope springs eternal. Anyway, it doesn't surprise me that Amy's siding with the terrorists in this regard, and with the State Department, with the U.S. State Department. Does not surprise me. It's really sad, though. It really is sad that she does that. But the main point that you're making here is that while the neocons have been pushing war propaganda against China for a good long time, the liberals have really jumped on the bandwagon, and even people who call themselves, quote, progressives, unquote, like Amy Goodman, you know, the people that are usually a little bit left of liberals, they have jumped on the State Department bandwagon of, I mean, and it's so ironic. Al Qaeda is the group that attacked the United States of America in 9/11 2001, and now these this State Department CIA cabal that you know doesn't change much. It hasn't changed any at all between the Obama regime and the Trump regime, they're pushing. They've been pushing this idea. The right wing has been pushing this idea of pushing war against China, which is an insane, absurd idea. But now the liberals have really jumped on the bandwagon. I mean, the liberals have really jumped on the bandwagon, and the progressives. You know, the people that the mass media calls the left in America, which they aren't the left, because progressivism and liberalism are right-wing ideologies, not left-wing ideologies. They are not the left. But, you know, these people have been jumping on this bandwagon ever since Obama pushed them to it with his pivot to Asia. And we know, you know, how much they're anti-other socialist workers' states in the world, like Vietnam and Kim and Laos and the People's Republic of Korea, People's Democratic Republic of Korea. Cuba, for instance, we know that they have always been anti-communist, so it's not that much of a surprise to me, because I expect liberals to be that way. Liberals posed for a bit of time, for a few decades, after the liberal sponsored war against Vietnam totally failed and went down in ignominy. For a while, they pretended to be anti-war. So I think a lot of people expect the Democrats and the liberals to be more anti-war than the Republicans, and they start to become surprised when they're not. But, I mean, certainly as of the time when Clinton was elected, which is quite a long time ago now, liberals have continued their traditional pro-war, pro-imperialist war, pro-anti-communist war, right along, just as unscheduled. And so, as I say, I'm not real surprised that the liberals are acting this way, but a lot of people have a delusional idea of what liberals are, and they have a delusional idea of what progressives are. and they think that they're more to the left than they really are. They listen to the mass media telling them that this is the left in the United States. So they fall for this propaganda, and they're delusional, really, because when you really look at what the liberals and progressives have done, how they've voted, they've always been pro-war. They've always been imperialistic, always been pro-capitalist and anti-socialist, anti-working class. They have always been that way. But they're in a kind of a bind, too, because for liberals to get elected, they have to pretend to be pro-working class. So their words are often different from their actions. Anyway, topic number five, why Trump scapegoats China. Now, this comes from an article in the it was on a publication that you're quite familiar with because you appear in it quite often, Rainer. Dandelion Salad. That's where I got this article. Anyway, it's called "Why Trump Scapegoats China" by Finian Cunningham, who I mentioned a little bit earlier already. But Finian goes into Trump's the same thing we've been talking about this whole episode. Trump's all-out propaganda war against China, trying to blame China for the COVID-19 virus, even though, you know, people like us have a lot of suspicions that the virus actually came from American laboratories. And he goes into Trump's war on the World Health Organization, which basically Trump is accusing of colluding with China because the World Health Organization verified what China had said by the way of statistics and so forth. Trump is now claiming that the statistics about COVID-19 coming from China are manufactured, that they're not real, that they're not reflecting the real numbers of infections and cases of death. However, the World Health Organization, they do have actual infectious disease experts who work for them, who were sent to China to investigate this data and these statistics, and they found that China was being totally, utterly honest with reporting what they knew about the virus and its unfolding in China starting in December, in late December. So he concludes at the very end of all this that Trump and other Western leaders are scapegoating China over the COVID-19 because they can't allow the public to ponder on the shameful and awful truth. That is, their governments let the people die unnecessarily. That's the real issue. This is a diversion, a total diversion. I mean, I think that this, and we'll get to this in just a bit, but I think that this, from the capitalist ruling class's perspective, from the espionage state, from their perspective, and they were, in my opinion, the people who started this, I think their aims and the Trump regime's aim were twofold. I think, number one, they aimed to damage the Chinese economy enough that that they would kind of knock the Chinese locomotive off the rails. And number two, they hoped that this would give them more fascistic control, as you might call it, more state police state control in the United States. Another side benefit of of Trump's current war against China and his claims that this that China lied to the world and that China is really responsible for the COVID-19 virus outbreak pandemic is that Trump is trying to divert attention from the fact of how poorly he has done as a leader during this public health crisis. He really wants to divert attention from that, although there has been a lot of attention. And Trump's numbers, by the way, are going down. Just in the last week, his approval ratings have fallen 7-8%, something in that range. His numbers are going down as more and more people start to see that he really has done a piss-poor job of managing this public health crisis, of responding to it, of mitigating it, of doing what was necessary early enough, especially since he had warning, as I said at the top of the show. From November, he had the warning. He should have done a lot more a lot sooner, and yet he didn't. And I think the reason he didn't is that he wanted the pandemic to be as serious as it has become in the United States, where we have a higher number of deaths and a higher number of infections than any other country in the world now. So, anyway, a little bit behind why Trump scapegoats China. Thoughts?
I can see where this is leading when what will follow logically after the campaign to scapegoat China for COVID-19 is a campaign to scapegoat China for the global economic depression. Already, at least some right-wing commentators have been making this, trying to start off this narrative. This month, Ben Shapiro made the statement that China has destroyed the world economy, and I think that as the economy continues to collapse in the coming months and years, China is going to be presented as the culprit, because the thing about the crisis we're experiencing is it's not just a virus that's going to go away within a couple of years. It's the start of a very long economic deterioration that the capitalist class needs to find a scapegoat for. The COVID-19 was only one of the catalysts that helped further along the global financial collapse that's been building up for a long time. And what we need to do is educate people about how the collapse began because of the U.S. corporations, not because of China. This crash is taking place ultimately because of the way the economy is structured, because of neoliberalism, not because we're being attacked by a foreign power. The suffering that people are going to be going through is going to be the result of the United States government constantly serving the big banks. And in fact, right now we're seeing an unprecedented effort to bail out the big banks while leaving the rest of us behind since last fall, the U.S. Federal Reserve has been rebailing out the banks, diverting trillions of dollars towards them. Well, the American people can only get something like a $1,200 check, and the U.S. political and media class is going to try to divert people's attention towards China. But we need to spread the truth. Capitalism is the cause of our hardship.
Yes, absolutely. And I really doubt that most Americans understand how little that $1,200 that they're throwing like some crumbs off the ruling class table at the working class, how little that really is compared to how enormous the trillions of dollars the United States government and the Fed have already given to the major banks, to many Fortune 500 companies, bailing them out during this period when many of them, really more due to their own ineptitude and due to their own bad management, would have gone under. In my opinion, those corporations should just simply be allowed to go under. They should be nationalized and put under public control. But we know that's not going to happen. That's something for people to think about in the future as to what should be happening. As people start more and more to understand how little was given to the American people, to the American working class, to help them through this crisis compared to how much the enormous amount that was given to the Fortune 500 and the big banks, people will start to get more and more angry. So I think that's something in the coming months and the coming years, Rainer, that we really need to hammer home to people. That once again, just like in 2008 with under Obama, Main Street was left to flounder while Wall Street was bailed out. It's the same story all over again. Anyway, let's see where we're at here on our topic list. Topic number 6. The American Empire's piracy against China. Now this, it's really, in the last week, this war against China, this American imperialist war against China has really been ramped up. Number one, the American government, the Trump regime, is encouraging people, individuals and companies, to sue China in court, claiming that they deserve reparations for the damage that China has done by causing the COVID-19 pandemic. This is all bogus, of course, we know that. However, these people are going to court trying to take the communist Chinese government and actually even the Chinese Communist Party to court in lawsuits and suing them and winning these lawsuits in a few cases already, and a lot more are to come. Trump is demanding reparations and saying that if he does not get those reparations from China, that he will confiscate Chinese-owned assets in the United States and in other places where the U.S. Empire rules, including confiscating shipping. This happened earlier, I think earlier this year, a North Korean ship was actually confiscated by the United States government and sold, and the proceeds were given to a family of an American student who died while under arrest in North Korea. So this kind of piracy has a precedent, and now they're threatening this kind of piracy against China. It's gotten to the point. This is a really an absurd, ridiculous level. In my opinion, at this point, President Xi really needs to get serious. He really needs to stop coddling the American empire and the Trump regime. He needs to take his kid gloves off, seriously. I mean, he needs to put China on a total war footing. He needs to put China on a total mobilization against the hybrid asymmetrical warfare the United States is waging against China and against this threat of piracy on the high seas, of piracy on land as well through banks. We've already seen the United States engage in this kind of piracy against Venezuela over the last year, confiscating billions of dollars of Venezuelan assets in the United States and turning those assets over to the bogus president, self-proclaimed President Guaido, claiming that Guaido is the legitimate president of Venezuela, which, of course, is every other country in the world looks and thinks, God, this Trump guy is really absurd if he thinks we're going to fall for that. So this piracy against China is a very real threat. And once again, as I've said a couple times during this show, this is the kind of big mistake that could lead to nuclear war. This is really serious. This could affect every human being on the planet, not just affect us, it could kill all of us. This is really fucking insane, and that's the only way I can put it. It is insane. Rainer, I know you're going to have more to say on this one, so speak up. Let's hear what you've got to say.
I want to caution against the more extreme expectations for what this piracy stuff means, since this is really in more of an economic wrecking move that I don't see as tied to nuclear tension. So of course there are ongoing war provocations in places like the South China Sea, and there's much evidence that the United States has been mobilizing its forces in the Indo-Pacific towards trying to militarily intimidate China. I guess you're right. There's definitely a buildup towards potential World War III scenario, and this reflects what we've been seeing for a long time throughout the last couple of years. Again, in the last couple of years, because this is really when the Cold War has been heating up the most, in particular. I remember that in it might have been October 2018, the Pentagon put out a document that said we need to prepare for a total war scenario with Russia and China, that we need to continue our America's military buildup, and I remember there was language in it about the need to incorporate facets of American institutions, business, finance, education, intelligence, government bureaucracy, towards this collective goal of countering China and preparing the United States for a World War III scenario. I mean, it's not like this is so far fetched. Even I've heard it said in the last month, reported by Abby Martin, that the U.S. sees open war with China as inevitable. So there's no telling what exactly that would look like, since neither side actually wants a World War III, obviously, like is the case with Russia, we're going to see continued provocations on the part of the United States and continued efforts from target country to defend from it. So, really, I think that the situation with China is more severe than the situation with Russia, because China is a more powerful country than Russia, and it's pretty clear that China is viewed as enemy number one by the United States and the West. I mean, if China is a country that's rapidly rising, more rapidly than ever amid the COVID-19 situation, and so the reaction from the American ruling class is to exacerbate Cold War tensions more than ever. We can only hope that it won't result in open war, as the government expects it will.
Yeah, it's not just, unfortunately, it's not just the American government that has those expectations. I do too, in the long run. As I explained with the build-up to the World War II, with the tensions between the United States and Japan, it became increasingly inevitable. This was an inter-imperialist war. Now, in today's economic situation, China, just by the mere fact of China rising up and creating a powerful economy, becomes a threat to U.S. hegemony, worldwide hegemony. That's what's causing this. As long as China, by its very existence as a successful socialist workers' state, as a successful state with a planned mixed socialist capitalist economy, threatens the economic hegemony of the United States. The United States will inevitably be led to this idea that it must destroy China's economic capacity. And how will it do that? They can try with this asymmetrical hybrid warfare that they've been doing for the last 10 years, but that hasn't worked, because China continues to grow. So unfortunately, it's the logic of capitalism, the logic of imperialism, that drives the evil American empire towards this inevitable end, which, you know, hopefully these idiots that run the American empire understand that a nuclear war will end everybody. It won't just end China, it will end America too, and it'll end everybody else, whether they were involved in it or not. That's what we the one thing that changed immediately in 1945, as soon as President Truman dropped the first atomic weapon on Japan, what immediately changed is the idea that you could continue to have conventional wars between powers that are nuclear powers. So hopefully that logic, it's, you know, it's called MAD, mutually assured destruction. Hopefully the logic of mutually assured destruction trumps the logic of empire and the logic of capitalism that has been pushing the American empire towards war with China. And in fact, in actual low-level hybrid asymmetrical warfare against China. Now, the Trump regime has been encouraging its closest allies to also engage in this form of piracy, of economic piracy, of of actual piracy on the high seas and actual piracy on the lands through using banks. And Germany has responded. The German government, the regime of Angela Merkel, who's not long for her position anymore, they actually sent bill to the Chinese government for $130 billion, claiming that this is what China has cost Germany by spreading its virus to Germany. I mean, as absurd as that is. So, this infection, the infection of actually contemplating war against China has even spread to Germany. It has even spread to Europe, and I won't be surprised to see America's most faithful lapdog, the UK, quickly follow suit. And, you know, this is not new, this idea of a state using piracy against another state, of a state actually, state-sponsored piracy, starting in the under the regime of Queen Elizabeth I in the 1600s, Britain started using piracy against France, Spain, and other of its competitors in mercantile capitalism. This idea has a long tradition, this idea of states sponsoring piracy against other states. During the 20th century, most states took the policy that piracy was wrong and that they should not support it, and that they should actually stamp it out. And that's why for most of the 20th century, piracy wasn't a big problem. But it's not surprising that the Americans are the first evil empire to start doing this in several hundred years, and that they're doing it against China. And now, as I say, Germany is following suit with their absurd $130 billion bill that they sent to China.
Now, Val, here's the question, though. Is China actually going to have to pay this?
Well, I mean, of course they're not going to pay it. But, Germany, I mean, there are Chinese assets in Germany. Chinese companies have to function in Germany. Chinese, telephone companies, for instance, like Huawei and, others have, billions of dollars of assets in Germany. So will Germany actually follow through and through acts of piracy confiscate Chinese assets in Germany? I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, I can guarantee you this much. Germany is going to suffer the most if they steal Chinese property from Chinese companies. I don't think that China is going to sit back. I mean, we've seen President Xi to be incredibly tolerant, incredibly cautious. The man is like a paragon of caution and tolerance, bending over backwards to accommodate these people who are hostile to his country and hostile to his country's interests. In the past, we've seen that with during this, ever since Obama started this hybrid asymmetrical war against China in 2011, Xi has been doing whatever he could to try to solve these issues diplomatically. But it should become obvious to him now, I hope it does, that diplomacy will not work with these belligerent imperialistic powers, these capitalistic imperialistic powers like Germany, like the UK, like France, like the United States. They will not be reasonable. They will not engage in real diplomacy. They'll engage in diplomacy, but it won't be sincere. So I think China really needs to change its attitude here. There's a big loss. I can understand why China doesn't want to do that, because China has a lot of trade, first of all, more primarily with the United States. The United States is China's leading trade partner. So there's an enormous amount of trade that China will lose. We know how much stuff people buy that says made in China on it in the United States, in Walmart and whatnot. So for China to really go on a total war footing with the United States, which would be only a recognition of the reality that the United States has already imposed upon them, that belligerent states like Germany have already imposed upon them, that will cost the Chinese economy a great deal. But you know what? In war, that's what you got to do. You know, you don't trade with your enemy during war. You cut off trade. So China needs to bite the bullet right now and come to recognize the reality that these countries, especially the American Empire, have been waging warfare against China for a good long time now, and they need to start getting serious about fighting back.
That's the thing about the China's system of government, though. Its model of socialism, it's modeled upon Dengism, which is the model that Deng Xiaoping implemented after the death of Mao, where China has been partially incorporating private business into China, and There are lots of good arguments for why this was the right move. It's helped China raise those 800 million people out of poverty. It's made China richer.
Right.
But there's a conflict between idealism and the pragmatism, the hard pragmatism that people like Deng have advocated for and that they've advanced. So the result now is China still kind of trying to not be too aggressive and to try to play the middle of that, if that's the right term. I wonder, I think it would be the case if China were still under the same economic model as the Mao era. So under that scenario, I think China would also be in an economically weaker it's a balance that they've had to figure out, and they've navigated economics and geopolitics. This is the the bottom line though is you and me support China. We recognize China as socialist. A lot of modern Maoists even don't recognize China as socialist. They reject it as a fraudulent kind of socialism. And I'm glad we've been able to come to this conclusion and have a more nuanced take on it.
Yeah. Well, those people who think that way, I mean, they're not authentic Marxist-Leninists. They're certainly not following Lenin's prescriptions for a mixed economy. I mean, they're being ridiculous. However, you know, I'll tell you my views about Mao Zedong, and I have studied Mao's writings. I've studied, I've read several biographies of Mao. I know his whole life pretty well. He was an extraordinary man. He was an extraordinary military leader. In fact, most people don't realize Mao's theories on guerrilla warfare are still taught in American military academies like West Point and Annapolis, you know, because he is the authority on guerrilla warfare. I mean, the man was simply brilliant. However, as a governor, I have a much more mixed, much more nuanced appreciation of Mao. To put it bluntly, I think there were several times when Mao was just a really poor governor, a really poor pilot of state. Ding was brilliant, much better at that. Zhou Enlai was much better at that, at being governors. Those guys were governors. As revolutionary strategists, those guys were kind of poor compared to Mao, but as governors, they were much, much better. This time, though, we are at a time where the engagement with the United States, which was started by Nixon and Mao in 1973, may simply be coming to an end. It has come to the point where it's outlived its usefulness. What China needs to do now, China doesn't need to ditch its Leninist economic system now, I don't think, anyway. I think they still need to go on with that, but they just need to adjust their focus towards Africa, which they've already done, towards Asia, which they've already done, away from the United States. Away from Western Europe. They need to focus on Eastern Europe more, Southern Europe more, not Western Europe, especially not the primary imperialist countries of Europe like France, Germany, Spain to a much, you know, lesser extent. But, you know, China needs to continue doing exactly what it has been doing in the past, which is refocus away from its alliance, its economic alliance with the United States, because the United States has become intransigent. The United States has become hostile, belligerent, and you know when you run up against a real belligerent, you don't usually do well through appeasement. Just as, you know, Great Britain found after 1938 with the belligerent Adolf Hitler. They tried to appease Adolf Hitler. It didn't work. It doesn't work when you have someone of that level of insanity, which, of course, Obama and Trump were equally insane, equally dictatorial, equally evil, imperialist capitalists. I mean, these kind of people, they are belligerent. They're not going to calmed down with appeasement. You know, you got to change your strategy in that case. You got to show muscle. China's got a lot of muscle, and what China really needs to do is shore up and strengthen its relationship with Russia, because while Russia is not as powerful as China is economically, Russia is a lot more powerful militarily. They have just much more sophisticated, much more advanced weapon systems, and China is going to need those weapon systems. I mean, China's already buying from Russia, but they need to do a lot more of that. They need to buy Russia's advanced weapon systems to fight off the American aggression. That's what they really need, in my opinion. You know, and I was pleasantly surprised. Patrice Granville responded to me when I said exactly what I just said right now. He responded saying, really well put, Chris. That was, exactly what needs to be said, you know. In a Facebook post that I did a couple of days ago, because I've been thinking a lot about this, about what China really needs to do to respond to this overt aggression, these overt acts of war by the American Empire. So, more thoughts?
Yeah, we'll
anything else?
We'll pay attention to China's actions in the coming years, how they're going to handle this stuff.
Yeah.
At least the good thing is that their military strength is already moving towards surpassing the United States, and they've been able to claim no infections, COVID-19 infections within their army, whereas the unhealthy U.S. Army has been struggling with COVID-19.
Absolutely. Okay. With that, I think we've come to an end. People who want more information about election boycott advocates, you can just simply plug election boycott advocates into the Facebook search engine, and we'll come popping up. You can join our page there. I bid everybody adieu until next week at this time, this channel. And until then, Rainer, it's been great talking to you.
Mm-hmm.